Anyway, it wouldn't be vodka that killed her. For something to do while she finished a Belvedere and Coke, she retrieved the titanium alloy attaché case from under the skirted chair. She took it to the bed and opened it, and considered the 21 banded packets of $100 bills. $210,000. She'd stolen it from a thief, though such street justice didn't make the money clean. This was war, however. Wars were expensive. She took 12 packets from the case and set them aside, the money she owed Enrique de Soto for the motorhome and the vehicle it would be towing when it arrived in Indio. A white plastic bag lined the little waste can in the bathroom. With a pair of scissors that she carried in one of two suitcases, she cut the bag into a flat sheet and used it to wrap the brick of money. She sealed the folded ends with scotch tape that she also carried in a suitcase. She was a well-prepared traveler. Scissors, tape, antacid, vodka, .45 compact with sound suppressor, switchblade, zip ties, spray bottle of chloroform that she had made herself from art store acetone by the action of chloride of lime. Damn if I'm not a regular Girl Scout. She went to bed, turned off the lamp, and slept. Chapter 54. Chris Roberts opens the door to Lori Longren's room, and Janice Dern looks up from the pile of books that she has torn apart.
See you a minute? Chris asks.
Leaving the chastened girl to lick the blood from the corner of her mouth, Janice steps into the hall and shuts the door behind her.
Chris says, I just got a call from Egon. They don't have the in-laws yet, but they're still in the chase.
Damn, Chris. We can't hold all these people indefinitely.
Won't have to. A support team of six is already on the road from Austin. Be here in maybe half an hour. They'll do sharp-elbow one-on-one interviews with all the employees being held in Stable 2, threaten them with prosecution for aiding and abetting Jane Hawk, scare the spunk out of them, and then send them home.
What about the Longrens?
Injections.
Shit, yeah! Janice high-fives Chris. Maybe we'll get Ansel and Claire before Egon does. Chase and Nick were best friends in high school. If the son of a bitch doesn't know where the in-laws went, if he hasn't been the contact between Jane and them, I'll tongue-kiss a rattlesnake.
Chris grins. Probably wouldn't be your first.
The quality of men these days? I'm either giving tongue to a rattlesnake or a gerbil. How many injection sets are we gonna have?
Egon didn't say what they're bringing. All we need is two.
If there's extra, I have a use for one. He looks at the closed door to Lori's room.
But she's only 12. Brain's still growing. Inject before they're 16. You know what'll happen.
I know what happened to a few. The sample was too small. It doesn't mean anything. Besides, after we convert the parents, the kids will know. Kids always know. They detect the difference. We'll have to do something with all three of the kids anyway.
Chris is uneasy. But after the work they've done together, he wants to be a good partner. All right. But I won't be there when you do it, or through the wait.
Earlier generations of the nanomechanism took 8 to 12 hours from the time of injection to the moment when control of the subject was established and he or she became an adjusted person. The newest generation of control mechanism requires only 4 hours. Janice says, if they bring just 2 injection sets, we could do Chase first, squeeze him for what he knows. If he gives us Ansel and Claire, we don't want wifey. I'll use the second set. She gestures toward the bedroom door, with the smart-mouthed tomboy in there. She doesn't need a translator to know the meaning of the look Chris gives her, but he's forthright about his desire.
Nobody can get a hate on faster or harder than you. You're so damn intense. I'd give just about anything to know what you're like in bed.
More than you could ever handle, sweet thing. We've been here before, and you know how it is. Partners don't do each other. Not if they want to stay sharp on the job. He sighs.
When the revolution's over, I'm gonna want to be totally in you.
She likes Chris. She really does. But his vision is limited to the short term, while she takes the long view.
A good revolution, she says, is never over. It's a way of life.
Chapter 55.
In the library of many chairs, there were also two deep, long, comfortable sofas facing each other from opposite ends of a gold-blue-maroon Persian carpet. Cornell often slept in one or the other. When he spent the night in the library instead of in the bunker, he was more likely to have pleasant sleep, as if his favorite authors were writing his dreams. This night, he put plump pillows and a blanket on each sofa. He placed small, chilled bottles of water on coasters on the tables that served the sofas. Beside each coaster, in a small plastic bag, he set a lemon cookie with chocolate chips in case either of them should wake in the night and want a convenient snack before going back to sleep. Travis used the bathroom first and brushed his teeth and put on white and black pajamas like a karate costume. Both sofas were big, but he took the smaller of the two. When Cornell entered the bathroom and saw what the boy had left there, his heart raced and his stomach turned over, and he needed to leave the room at once. The boy was lying on the sofa, arranging the blanket around himself, one dog up there with him, the other dog on the floor next to its master's slippers. Cornell said,
You left a thing in there so I can't use the sink.
I flushed, the boy assured him.
Yes, 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 you did flush, please and thank you. But beside the sink you left a little plastic glass. And in the glass you left a little tube of toothpaste and your toothbrush. Left it in the little glass, in the little glass, in the little glass.
Where should I leave it?
Not in the bathroom. Leave it with your things. On the table, there, with your water and your cookie would be okay. That would be okay. That would be good.
The boy folded back the blanket and sat up.
Okay. Sure. Sorry I left it there. But why?
Cornell stood fidgeting, shifting from foot to foot, wondering if the dogs would decide to attack him after all.
Well, it's a toothbrush, and a toothbrush is a very personal thing, very. And when there's a toothbrush not mine standing by the sink where I'm going to brush my own teeth, it's like being gouged. No, I mean like being touched, and I can never be touched.
Uncle Gavin explained how that is.
The boy stepped into his slippers.
But I guess I didn't know about the toothbrush thing.
Neither did I.
Cornell shuddered.
It's a surprise.
The boy got the plastic glass with the toothbrush and brought it back to his sofa and put it on the table beside his cookie.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jesperson.
No need to be sorry. No need. No need. You didn't know. I didn't know. Nobody knew.
Cornell went into the bathroom and brushed his teeth and changed into his pajamas, which were soft and blue like the sky. He could sleep well only in soft and blue. In the library once more, he turned out all the lights except for a blown glass lamp at the end of the sofa farthest from his head. A soft, peach-color glow issued from it.
"I always leave on one lamp," Cornell said. "Is that okay?"
"Sure. Even though there aren't boogeymen or nothing, it's still nice not to sleep in the dark."
Cornell settled on his sofa, pulled the blanket over himself. He turned on his side and looked across the Persian carpet to the boy with his dogs.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I guess. Are you okay?"
"I'm okay.
What do you want to say?" the boy asked.
Cornell pointed behind his head to the table that stood beside the sofa.
"Do you see the iPod there?"
"Yeah, I see it."
"Sometimes, at night, if I wake up and I'm scared, I play music that makes me feel better. Is that okay? I'll play it low."
"It won't bother me. My mom's a musician. She plays the piano. She's really good.
I'm looking forward to meeting your mother.
You'll like her. Everyone likes her. Except all the bad guys she puts in prison. She's the best.
Cornell says.
She'll be here soon.
She promised, the boy said. She always keeps promises.
Both dogs yawned extravagantly, as if the conversation bored them. Cornell didn't want to offend the dogs, so he said no more. Soon, the boy was softly snoring. Cornell lay watching the boy and the big dogs, amazed that they were here, that his guest had liked the lunch sandwiches, also the different sandwiches for dinner. He was amazed that he had read most of the Bradbury novel aloud to the boy. Always before, Cornell had liked everything to be just the same today as it had been yesterday, and he had hoped tomorrow would be the same as today. Now, everything was different, and he wanted tomorrow to be the same kind of different as today. On the other hand, if things could get so different from one day to the next, they could get different all over again, and maybe the next time in not such a nice way. Part 2. While Jane Sleeps. Chapter 1. Lori Longren was a strong and happy girl because her family was strong and happy. She had figured that out long ago. If your family was a mess, your dad a sex-crazed tail chaser and your mom one of those who floated her breakfast cornflakes in booze, well, then your chances of being strong and happy weren't promising. But if your dad and mom loved each other and worked hard, especially when their work brought beautiful horses into your life every day, you were more than halfway to being strong and happy. The rest was up to you. Of course, Lori could still screw up, like when she zoned out or even fell asleep during nearly every Sunday sermon, or like when she used the word horse shit more often than the average almost 13-year-old girl. If you were strong and happy, you were able to recognize those qualities in others, and if you could admit to your own evils, like the overuse of the word horseshit or a tendency to get snarky with ignorant people, just to name two, then you were better able to see evil in others and know them for what they were. For instance, Agent Janice Dern, who was an FBI bad apple if she was FBI at all, who wasn't just psycho sick, but also as pure evil as Cruella de Vil. Except, if given the chance, Janice Dern wouldn't make a fancy coat from Dalmatian puppy skins, but instead from little girl skins. When she stepped out of the room to talk with the guy named Chris, Janice closed the door, but they didn't lower their voices. Lori could still hear them. She was pretty sure Janice wanted her to hear them. When Janice had first talked about the injections that would make Lori a zombie, it had sounded half true and half like, well, horse shit. But she and Chris talked about 6 more of their kind coming here as backup, talked about injecting Daddy and maybe Mom and maybe Lori herself, and the more they talked, the more real it sounded. Too real by the time they were talking about sex and doing each other. Lori wasn't just sitting there, zip-tied to her desk chair, hysterical about the danger she was in, hoping Ethan Stackpoole would miraculously appear and rescue her from death and worse than death. Ethan Stackpoole was amazing to look at, sweet, smart, strong for his age. But he was in the 7th grade, like Lori, so he was still a few years away from being an action hero able to knock the plumbing out of a dozen bad guys. Although she couldn't help thinking about Ethan Stackpoole at times like this, and lots of other times, Lori was busy saving herself the minute Janice stepped into the upstairs hallway and closed the door behind her. Evil is stupid. Doing evil might get you what you wanted in the short term, but it never worked in the long term. Lori had learned this from books, from some movies, and just from general observation of life. For instance, in the general observation category, Janice Dern was evil and stupid. She'd bound each of Lori's ankles to the front stretcher bar of the desk chair and her left hand to the left arm of the chair, but let the right hand remain free so she could make that idiotic, nasty crack about nose-picking and booger-eating.
Janice probably also didn't cuff that hand because when the two of them were face to face and she was ragging Lori, she wanted to be given the finger and really would have used the butt of her pistol like a hammer, as she had promised, to shatter all three knuckles in the offending digit. But Janice Dern, agent of the FBEI, Federal Bureau of Evil Idiots, had apparently given no thought to what might be in the drawers of a schoolgirl's desk besides bubblegum and barrettes. Among other things, Lori's desk contained a pair of scissors. The moment the door closed, while Lori listened to the crazy sick talk of the two agents and thought about Ethan Stackpool, she opened the pencil drawer in the desk and took out the scissors. She cut through the thick plastic tie that restrained her left hand. She bent forward in the chair and cut the tie on her left ankle, then the tie on her right. With her left hand, she presented the middle finger to the hallway door, and she kept the scissors in her right hand because they were the only weapon she had. Only a day earlier, she would not have thought she could stab anyone, not in a million years. But now that the choice was between stabbing someone or being turned into a zombie slave, she could be a stabbing machine if it came to that. Waiting for Janice to return and trying to surprise her was a bad idea. Janice was strong, crazy, and evil. Better to raise the bottom sash of the double-hung windows, raise the bug screen, and slip out onto the roof of the veranda that encircled the house. She was on the north side of the house, where she couldn't be seen from the stables, though she was looking down on the Cadillac Escalade that blocked the private lane leading in from the state route. The Cadillac stood under a lamppost. A woman leaned against the farther side of the big SUV, smoking a cigarette, her back to Lori. Because the veranda wrapped the entire residence, Lori was able to move along the shingled roof, around the corner to the back, the west side, where she was not visible from either the driveway or any of the stables. To the west lay a fenced meadow. Beyond that, open grassland and a lot of darkness. Lights at two other spreads, one to the north, one to the south, were so far away they looked not like ranches, but like distant ships on a vast, dark sea. She could jump down to the backyard and try to make her way to Stable 5, far from where they were holding the employees in Stable 2. She could find a suitable mare and ride out for help. But in a minute or two, Janice would discover her prisoner had escaped, and in 3 minutes, every FBEI agent on the property would be hunting her. There wouldn't be time to saddle the mare. Lori would have to ride bareback, which she could do, though there might not even be time for that. Besides, these people were big-time bad hats, rotten enough to kill people, so they might shoot a horse out from under her if given the chance. She couldn't live with herself if she was responsible for the death of a horse. The other alternative was to enter the house by a window of a different room, and then go to a place that these invaders might not know about, where there was a phone that she could use. Her parents' bedroom was here at the back of the house. At this time of year, the upstairs windows were never locked because they were often opened for fresh air. The bedroom was dark beyond the glass. She quietly slid up a bug screen, and then the lower sash of a window. Chapter 2. Several miles south of the town of Borrego Springs, the Anza-Borrego Desert, Monday fading into Tuesday, the temperature still at 79 degrees, almost 6 hours after nightfall. The valley floor in this area stubbled with mesquite and sage and nameless brush, but nonetheless ashen under a paling moon, as eerie as some dreamscape where alien terrors wait below to ascend through sandy soil as easily as sharks through water. Along this lonely stretch of Borrego Springs Road, the sign stands where it was erected Monday afternoon. U.S. Department of the Interior, Desert Flora Study Group. Trespassers will be prosecuted. There is no Desert Flora Study Group. Trespassers will, however, be prosecuted, though prosecution might be the least that will be done to them. Beyond the sign is a tent, 40 feet on a side and 10 feet high, with 7 or 8 people busy therein. The tent contains a communications hub through which a task force of 80 agents, already in the valley, is being organized, instructed, and tracked in the search for young Travis Hawk and his mother. 4 computer workstations, manned around the clock, enable field operatives to call in the names of locals whom they determine suspicious, license plate numbers, and other inquiries that can then be expeditiously researched through the numerous law enforcement and government intelligence agency data troves to which Arcadians have access. A freezer full of pizzas and sandwiches, 2 microwave ovens, and a refrigerator containing bottled water and sodas provide minimum amenities, though most agents in the search party will get their meals from fast food outlets in Borrego Springs. Behind the tent are 3 large trucks. One contains tanks of propane and the generator that powers this temporary installation. On its roof, a satellite dish is canted toward the stars. The second truck provides 6 spacious portable toilets with sinks and running water. The third is fitted out as a dormitory, offering beds for 10, though most of the agents will sleep in their vehicles as the need for rest overcomes them. The most reasonable projection of the task force commander and his advisors is that the boy will be found and his mother captured or killed within the next 24 hours. Carter Jurgen stands just outside the open zippered flap door of the tent in the outfall of light, staring across the highway at more pale wasteland, and then dark mountains rising like a wall that make him feel as if he's in an ancient crater where a frightful mass impacted millennia ago. When he looks at the sky, the stars and moon seem menacing, as though the universe is a mechanism with a million-year cycle that, in its current repetition, is shortly to arrive at the fateful moment when an asteroid slams into this same ground, instantly pulverizing him so that no scrap of flesh or bit of bone will remain to prove he ever existed. Of course, it's not an incoming asteroid he fears. Irrationally, it's a human being, a mere 125-pound woman with the looks of a supermodel. She has proved so difficult to kill that it seems as though, while still an infant, she must have been dipped in the water of immortality, like the Trojan war hero Achilles, except that even the entire foot by which she'd been held had been submerged, leaving her without a vulnerable Achilles heel. After the shootout in the market, where they killed Gavin and Jessica Washington on Sunday afternoon, Carter Jurgen and Radley DuBose, acting as agents of the National Security Agency, but in fact serving the techno-Arcadian agenda, had called in backup to assist in the search for Travis Hawk, and to prepare for what seems to be an inevitable attempt by his mother to get to her son first and spirit him out of the area to a new safe haven. Jurgen wishes they had taken the 2 guardians of the boy by surprise, so they could either have tortured them or injected them with control mechanisms to learn the child's whereabouts. If they have the boy, they'll have Jane. Better yet, kill him, and thereby break her spirit beyond recovery. Homeland has run a psychological profile of Jane Hawk. They predict a 90% chance that if they catch and kill the boy, she will be so shattered by her failure to protect him, she'll kill herself, sparing them from having to face off against her. Jurgen might take more solace from the conclusions of that report if Homeland's profiles of potential foreign and domestic terrorists had not usually been woefully poor predictors of those individuals' true intentions, behavior, and prospects. The outfall of light in which Jurgen stands now abruptly diminishes to such an extent that he can be pretty sure Radley DuBose has followed him out of the tent. DuBose, the pride of Crap County, West Virginia, had been accepted into Princeton, perhaps by a chronically intoxicated dean of admissions, and had graduated, no doubt, by delivering in person a threat to disembowel the president of the university if denied a diploma. He stands about 6'5" and weighs around 230 pounds, and Jurgen thinks it's a sure bet that DuBose's DNA traces back to 40,000 BC, to an early Cro-Magnon generation, and an ancestor who was the first hired thug in service to the first petty dictator in human history. Although he fills a doorway with his physical bulk and can paralyze a rabid wolf with his glower, DuBose moves with the grace of a dancer and perfect stealth. Only the occlusion of light from within the tent is a clue to his presence.
Jürgen can't even hear his partner breathing. Still staring at the sky, Jürgen says, I know the valley isn't a crater, but it feels like one. Do you ever wonder if something big and fast is coming out of all those stars? Some asteroid that'll make us as extinct as the dinosaurs? DeBose says,
The only asteroid coming down right now is me. And the only shit I'm going to make extinct is that tight-ass hawk bitch and the little brat that popped out of her twat 5 years ago.
Jürgen sighs. Princeton certainly imparts to its graduates a flair for colorful expression.
What is it with your fixation on where we went to school? You're 37. I'm 35. Princeton was just a stupid thing I had to get through to go where I wanted. Do you have some kind of weird sentimental attachment to Harvard?
As DuBose looms at his side, Jürgen says, Generations of my family's men have graduated from Harvard. It's a matter of family pride, achievement, tradition.
There it is again. That freaky Boston Brahmin way of looking at the world. Going to classes, playing lacrosse, pledging a fraternity. None of that involves risk. And the only reward is the status you have in the eyes of the ever fewer number of people who think Harvard is special. That's not an achievement.
I suppose you'll tell me what is.
Generations of my family have distilled whiskey, grown pot, sold capsules of speed and ecstasy, and never got caught. Now there you have a truly awesome tradition and achievement.
Selling drugs to children might be a tradition, but it's not an achievement.
My old man and uncle never sold younger than middle school. A 14-year-old isn't a child. Hell, that's the age of consent.
It isn't the age of consent, not even in the darkest hollers of West Virginia.
It used to be, DuBose says.
Yeah. And if you go back a century or two, most places didn't even bother having an age of consent. DuBose puts an arm around Jürgen's shoulders in a gesture of unwelcome camaraderie.
Those were the days, huh? Too bad we don't have a time machine.
He pats Jürgen's shoulder.
We've had 4 hours of sleep, some terrific pizza, and enough caffeine to make a sloth hyperactive. Let's get on the hunt.
Like the fearsome, rough beast in Yeats's poem that slouches toward Bethlehem to be born, DuBose moves toward a row of vehicles parked in darkness on the south side of the tent. Jürgen follows.
It wasn't terrific pizza, it sucked. Because you had that pizza for pussies. Nothing on the cheese but black olives, mushrooms, some kind of fairy grass.
It was cilantro.
If you'd had the five meat pizza, you'd feel fortified.
Carter Jürgen winces at the memory of the gross slabs of meat and cheese DuBose consumed. In time, that festival of flesh is going to inspire a butthorn serenade, and Jürgen lacks a gas mask. Because the masters of this revolution believe in granting perks to the agents who carry out their orders, especially as the cost of doing so is borne by taxpayers, they provide cool wheels. The pure jazz vehicle recently assigned to Jürgen and DuBose is a Hennessy Velociraptor 6x6, an 800-horsepower bespoke version of the four-door Ford F-150 Raptor with new axles, two additional wheels, kick-ass off-road tires, and a long list of other upgrades. It is big, black, glossy, and fabulous. DuBose is in possession of the keys, as he has been since they received the Velociraptor the previous Friday evening.
I'll take the wheel this time, says Jürgen.
What wheel is that?
DuBose wonders as he climbs into the driver's seat and pulls the door shut. Jürgen rides shotgun. Chapter 3 Lori Longren, in the mystery of her parents' bedroom, the faintest thread of light under the door to the hallway, draperies closed at one of the three windows, the other two offering only swaths of the black Texas prairie night, the stars too far away to aid her vision. She helped with housework and sometimes cleaned here, so she knew the layout well enough to feel along the bed, past the bench at the foot of it, on which the quilted spread was folded at day's end, and across an open area to a dresser. Magically,
The oval mirror in the dresser seemed to gather what feeble light the room contained, presenting less like a mirror than like a window into a deeply shadowed room in a parallel world, where everything had a subtle gloss, and where a figure that might have been a girl, or the ghost of a girl, stood featureless and fearful. What Lori feared was failing to get out of there and up to safety before Janice Dern and Chris whoever stopped talking about sex and death in the upstairs hall. When the vicious Dern beast returned to Lori's bedroom, that horrible creature would realize she had stupidly allowed her captive to escape, and she'd sound an alarm. A search of the house might begin simultaneously with a search of the immediate grounds. To the left of the dresser was a door to the master bathroom. To the right, a closet door. In the blinding dark, her trembling fingers found the lever handle on the closet door, which would make a ratcheting noise if operated too fast. She eased the handle down from horizontal. The door, if swollen, sometimes stuttered against the jamb, so she pulled carefully on it. In the walk-in closet, she closed the door and dared to switch on the light. Standing tiptoe, she could barely reach the loop on the end of the cord that allowed her to pull down the trapdoor in the ceiling, to the back of which was fixed a folded ladder. The heavy springs on the trap protested, but she doubted that the sound could be heard through two closed doors and as far away as the hallway. The ladder automatically unfolded its three segments as the trapdoor opened. She clicked the wall switch, and in blackness, purified of light, climbed monkey-like on all fours. She scampered into the attic, felt blindly for the recall lever in the trapdoor frame, found it, and grimaced as the three sections of rungs accordioned upward with more noise than they had made when descending to the closet floor, although perhaps still not making enough racket to draw anyone's attention. The ladder-loaded trap returned to its frame with a soft thump. The attic had a finished floor of plywood. In this raftered darkness, which was high enough for her father to stand erect, boxes were stacked in rows, all of Christmas, except the tree, sealed in cardboard, excess books displaced from shelves downstairs, souvenirs of times and places that were too distant to be of current interest, but too important to be discarded. Mother's glorious wedding dress in a zippered vinyl bag inside a cedar-lined chest. With her arms held out to the left and right, her fingertips sliding along palisades of cardboard, Lori inched blindly forward. Her father had installed this flooring when the house was remodeled, not long before her birth. He used the best materials and secured the plywood to the joists with screws instead of nails. But here and there, between the plies, were small voids that squeaked underfoot. This center aisle pretty much aligned with the second-floor hall, where Janice Dern and Chris Horny Dude might still be discussing his inexplicable lust for her and her cool indifference. If enough squeaking arose in the ceiling above them, they might decide that the cause was something more than mice. The attic received a cleaning twice a year, but dust gathered there in the interim, and Lori disturbed it in her passage. An unspent sneeze teased her nose, and she paused to pinch her nostrils shut until the urge passed. Only she could hear her stampeding heart, though the pounding made it harder to judge how much noise she was making otherwise. With the sneeze quelled, she began to move again, only to press her face through the silken strands of a spiderweb that masked her from brow to chin. Startled, she paused to wipe off those sticky threads, wondering if the eight-legged architect might even now be crawling through her hair. Stay cool. Even if a spider was in her hair, it wouldn't bite. If it did bite, the bite wouldn't harm her unless the biter was a brown recluse. It wasn't a brown recluse. She just knew it wasn't. Suddenly, from below, came the voice of the beast at a volume to rattle windows. The little bitch! The little shit! She's gone! Followed by other voices and slamming doors and swift footfalls on the front stairs. Confident that what noises she made would now be covered by the hubbub below, Lori moved more quickly through the high dark, with her left hand still sliding along stacked boxes, but her right arm extended in front of her. She halted when her out-thrust hand made contact with cold steel. She felt her way around the tight coil and entered the open spiral stairs. The treads were padded with rubber, and the handrail kept her steady. She made only a little noise as she climbed into the round room at the very top and center of the house, where the encircling windows admitted the light of moon and stars. This space was 10 feet in diameter, like an enclosed widow's walk where the wives of fishermen went to keep a lookout for their menfolk's boats at sea. The sea, in this case, was the plain that stretched to every horizon, lush with tall grass, and when anyone climbed up here with dread in his heart, he came to monitor not fishing trawlers, but the progress of fire. Some years the rains didn't come, but the sun did, and the wind did, and the sun and the wind made dry kindling of the grass across those thousands of acres. Nature nurtured, but it also afflicted. There were times when thunder seemed to announce a storm, but the sky proved to be filled with more bang and flash than with rain, the latter falling in barely enough quantity to chase the birds to their roosts for a few minutes, while the lightning spat fire onto the plain. If the wind was fierce, the vast fields of wild grass could raise walls of flame 30 feet high, even higher, and the fire front moved as fast as a train. Owning a quantity of horses and not enough transports to move them all at once, you wanted to monitor the burning plain from a high vantage point, to know in which direction and at what pace the blaze might be advancing. The round chamber was mostly glass, but on a shelf between two windows stood one of the 8-line hybrid phones that also served as an intercom, featuring an indicator board with labeled buttons for nearly every room in the house and for each of the stables. Lori was pretty sure they would search the house for her, but that the search wouldn't extend to the attic. They would expect that she had fled, perhaps to mount a horse or to run out to the state highway in hope of encountering a motorist who might help. Whatever these people were, they weren't real FBI. Real FBI agents didn't want to use brain implants to make slaves out of people, and they didn't tear up a kid's book collection, and they didn't promise to make you over into Little Miss Lickspittle. These FBI imposters wouldn't want the county sheriff's department showing up to check out a report of armed thugs holding hostages. Maybe they would just skedaddle. As Lori reached for the phone, she was struck by the thought that perhaps these intruders were FBI, after all. FBI gone bad, like in the movies, wicked and corrupt. If they had real ID and could prove to the sheriff who they were, then maybe the sheriff would just go away. Or what if? If some FBI agents could be so evil, maybe the county sheriff and his deputies couldn't be trusted either. Maybe they would take her call and listen with concern and promise to come right away with sirens blaring, but would instead phone the hideous Dernbeast or Chris Sexfiend and say, "The little bitch is in the lookout at the top of the house." Then the FBI bad hats would come running up here and inject her, and she would have to kiss the Dern monster's ass every time she was ordered to kiss it. Lori stood in the dark room, gazing out at the dark plain, and all that darkness seemed to be seeping into her through her eyes and ears and nose. Although rain had fallen this season, and the grass was green, she wished for fire and wind and walls of flame to scare away these hateful invaders. Then she realized who she could trust. Firemen. The county had several well-equipped fire stations here and there, and a network of volunteer firemen and firewomen who had undergone training. Her dad was one of them. The firemen were all good people looking out for one another. She knew many of them, because they got together on Memorial Day and Labor Day for a picnic and games, and again for an evening celebration at a rented hall in Worcester each December. The chief of the volunteers was Mr. Linwood Haney. His wife, Corinne, was a firewoman. They had a daughter, Bonnie Jean, better known as BJ, who was Lori's age. BJ, who liked horses and motorbikes, wanted to be a marine sniper when she grew up, and the Haneys lived only 3 miles away, which was just about next door. So it was inevitable, like destiny or something, that she and Lori were friends. Mr. and Mrs. Haney would for sure believe her, and they would come with other firemen and firewomen. Until she picked up the handset, Lori forgot that doing so would cause a green indicator light to appear on the intercom panel beside the label marked Firewatch. In fact, the same green indicator had at that instant lit on every phone in the house and the stables, just to the right of the dark buttons labeled Master Bed and Master Bath. Maybe none of these intruders had previously noticed the words Firewatch on the phone boards. But if one of the creeps happened to be looking at a phone now, he'd wonder where the Firewatch was and who might be using a phone at that location. She quickly returned the handset to its cradle. The green light winked off. For a long moment, she stood shaking, trying to think what else she could do. Nothing. There was nothing to be done but call the Haneys, wake them, and persuade them to marshal the volunteer firemen. Be brief, but persuasive. Brief enough so that maybe none of the Bad Hat FBI agents would notice the Firewatch light, but convincing enough that Mr. Haney wouldn't think she was pranking him and wouldn't call back to talk to her parents, thereby alerting the Dern Beast and her perverted pals. Lori couldn't stop shaking. She didn't like being a scaredy cat. She wasn't a scaredy cat, just prudent. Mother said prudence was one of the greater virtues. Horseshit! This wasn't prudence. This was gutless fear. What would that cute Ethan Stackpool think of her if he could see her now? She picked up the handset. Green light. She put the handset down. She picked it up. Green light. She almost put it down again, but then she entered the Haney's number.
Chapter 4. They cruise in the jacked-up Velociraptor, lords of the night, the engine grumbling low, like the voice of some pagan animal god that, in simmering wrath, has stepped out of eternity and into time to hand down hard judgments. Although he knows the question won't be adequately answered, from his shotgun position, Jurgen says, "What are we looking for?"
"Indications. Signs. Manifestations. Clues,"
DuBose replies. "And how will we know them when we see them?"
"I'm not sure how you will know them, my friend, but I'll see them as stains on the fabric of normalcy."
So, as sometimes he does, the Hulk is going to pretend to the brilliance of Sherlock Holmes. The 5 hours till dawn might seem like 100 before the sun rises at last. County Highway S3 and Borrego Springs Road are two of the four principal entrances to the valley. 3 miles south of the junction of those roads, DuBose slows as he passes a truck bearing the power company's name, which stands just off the pavement along Highway S3, as though loaded with materials and parked in anticipation of some project that will be started in the morning when a crew returns. In fact, the truck is the property of the NSA, and contains a bank of lithium batteries that will power its camera and transmitter for 48 hours. The camera is a license plate scanner that reads the tags on passing vehicles that have turned off California State Highway 78 and come north toward Borrego Springs. The image of every plate will be received in real time at the Desert Flora Study Group tent, where agents keep open back doors to California's and neighboring states' DMVs, ready quickly to identify to whom each vehicle is registered. A similar truck is parked along Borrego Springs Road, a half mile north of Highway 78. At two strategic points just inside the valley, along County Highway S-22, which passes east-west through the town of Borrego Springs, other vehicles are performing the same function under different disguises. Every car, SUV, van, truck, motorhome, and bus entering the valley is scrutinized. Any smallest reason for suspicion triggers an investigation of the people in the suspect vehicle. If Jane Hawk uses one of several unpaved tracks to enter the valley, or if she comes off-road altogether in an all-wheel drive vehicle, men positioned at key points throughout that rough terrain will surely see her. They will scope her out, report her, and relay the tracking of her from one spotter to another until she can be intercepted and arrested when she arrives at a paved highway, if not before. They don't believe she will get here before noon tomorrow. She will not rush in pell-mell. She'll take time to think it through, devise a plan.
occupying the driver's seat as if it is his birthright. Radley DuBose picks at the scab that hasn't healed over an injustice that frustrates him.
These desk jockey chicken shits we take orders from. Do they have the balls to do what's necessary to take this country and make it ours? They should have let us inject every sheriff's deputy, use them to augment our forces. Then we could lock down the town and the entire valley the moment we think she's here. Make it a freaking concentration camp and grind our way through it door to door till we've found the bitch and the kid.
Having long ago taken it upon himself to be the voice of reason in moments when the West Virginia hillbilly wants to do surgery with a chainsaw instead of a scalpel, Jurgen responds in a low and even tone of voice. There wasn't time to inject so many.
Plenty of time, DuBose disagrees. The new control mechanism takes just 4 hours to assemble in the brain.
The San Diego County Sheriff's Department maintains a substation in Borrego Springs. Immediately following the shooting of Gavin and Jessica Washington, the watch captain, a man named Foursquare, and some deputies proceeded as if they had authority to investigate. They backed off when Jurgen was able to put Captain Foursquare on the phone with the deputy director of the NSA, a former United States senator who was known as a friend of law enforcement, and who assured Foursquare that this was a matter of national security, though the name Jane Hawk was not mentioned. Jurgen perseveres. Trying to overpower and inject deputies who are well-armed even off-duty, who are suspicious by their very nature and trained to resist aggression, we couldn't have taken them all by surprise. It would have gotten messy. Mistaking his hardball tactics for brilliant strategy, DuBose says,
"Yes, all right, a few maybe you can't take by surprise and inject. Big deal, so you blow their brains out. Then you pin the deaths on Jane after she's either captured or worm food."
"And what if one of the deputies you intend to kill instead kills you?" Looking away from the road, regarding Jurgen as he might a slow-witted child, the big man says,
"Like that could happen."
"Anyway," Jurgen says, "by the time Jane is here, we'll have that little zombie army you want, all of them locals who know the area, a lot more of them than all the deputies at the substation." Crews have been busy for 24 hours, identifying easy targets for injection, approaching them as FBI agents, converting them into adjusted people in the privacy of their homes, more than 40 thus far. DuBose is dismissive.
"They're civilians, not in uniform. They can't openly carry guns like the deputies can."
"Not every problem can be settled with a gun," Jurgen says. DuBose favors him with that pitying look again, but before the Hulk can reply, Jurgen's smartphone rings. It's from the guy manning the communications hub at the Desert Flora Study Group. Something has gone wrong at one of the houses in which injections are being administered. Chapter 5. Lori Longren, in the firewatch room, like a bird in a glass cage, unable to fly away, unable to go down below where all the nasty cats were eager to find her and tear off her wings. When Mr. Linwood Haney answered the phone, having surely been awakened from sleep, Lori said, "It's me, Lori. Lori Longren, at Longren Stables. Terrible things are happening here, Mr. Haney." By the time she had said that much, she became a motor mouth, words spinning from her at high speed.
"They say FBI. It's a lie. They're rotten. They want Mr. and Mrs. Hawk where they've gone. Mom and Dad tied up. This crazy woman hit me. She has a gun. All of them guns. Six. And six more coming. They want to kill us or worse. I'm in the fire watch. They'll find me soon. I don't trust the sheriff. I only trust you."
Mr. Haney calmed her, though she surprised herself when she interrupted him more than once with additional details of what had happened at Longren Stables. She couldn't quite control herself. She was dismayed at the sharp fear in her voice, because she prided herself on being less of a child than some others her age, on being of sturdy Texas rancher stock. However, it was only when she started talking to Mr. Haney that she truly realized the full extent of the danger to herself, to her parents and sisters. Oh, she'd known they were in deep shit. She wasn't stupid. But somehow, she'd not let herself think clearly about the worst that might happen. Maybe because thinking about it would have paralyzed her. When she told Mr. Haney that these vicious, rotten people wanted to kill them, or worse, the possibility of such a horror became more real when she heard herself put it into words. So real that her fear flashed into fright, hampering her breathing and raising a pain in her chest, as if some demonic angler had cast a line and snared her heart with one of those fishing lures that had multiple wicked hooks. She took hope when Mr. Haney believed her. He said,
"Something like this happened at Ansel and Claire's place Sunday night. Stay calm, Lori. Stay where you are. We're coming. Everything will be okay."
Staring at the phone, at the green light burning beside the words "Firewatch," Lori said, "Hurry. Please. Please hurry." And she hung up. Chapter 6. Fewer than 4,000 residents live in Borrego Springs itself, a desert town that Carter Jurgen finds offensive to his every sense and sensibility. The place is too warm, too dry, too dusty, the backwater of all backwaters, with only a pittance of water. Many of the palm trees appear stressed, and the only real grass of which he's aware is in Christmas Circle, a park in the center of town. There are acres and acres of concrete and blacktop, and more acres of nearly barren desert that reach here and there into the town's precincts. As if the Anza Borrego Desert is aware of this human encroachment and remains determined to reclaim everything sooner than later. He has seen neither a restaurant serving four-star French cuisine, nor one of any kind in which he would want to eat, nor a motel with even half the number of stars in its rating that he would require before staying there, nor a clothing store carrying the finest designer brands. The so-called art gallery contains not one item that resembles any school of art he studied during his university days or since. Inexplicably, the people who live here seem happy. They are friendly to an annoying extent, saying to him, a total stranger, "Lovely weather," and "Good morning," and "Have a nice day." He's been in the valley for almost 36 hours. If he had to live here the rest of his life, he'd go into the garage and close it up tight and start the car engine and wait to die of carbon monoxide poisoning. Indeed, he'd get down on the garage floor and suck eagerly on the tailpipe to speed up the process. When this revolution is won, he will spend his time only in the most cosmopolitan of cities and resorts. Maybe the citizens who live in the desiccated heart of Borrego Springs are happy because they feel greatly superior to those benighted souls who live down valley in small clusters of residences, or even in isolated single homes, served by crudely paved or dirt roads. Jurgen and Dubose have been summoned to one of these curious neighborhoods that consists of four single-story stucco houses on spacious, grassless lots along an unpaved street off Borrego Springs Road. An unmarked black Jeep Grand Cherokee blocks the entrance, manned by two Arcadians in jackets emblazoned with the letters FBI. Because of an orientation meeting that they conducted Monday morning, Jurgen and Dubose are known to every operative who has descended on the valley, whether they are FBI, NSA, Homeland, or carry multiple credentials. The Velociraptor is waved through the roadblock, beyond which four more black Jeep Grand Cherokees are parked along the dead-end street, one in front of each house. Dubose stops at the address to which they have been summoned, and they step out of the monster Ford. On an ordinary night, this neighborhood, lacking street lamps, would lie deep in darkness past 2 a.m. Now, windows glow in the houses, providing enough ambient light, along with the declining moon, to see large moths capering for the delectation of bats that, with a thrum of membranous wings, swoop low and soar and swoop again, dining in flight. Instead of a lawn, a thick layer of smooth, plum-sized stones surrounds the house, as though giant mythical birds, perhaps a flock of Arabian rocs, have stopped here during the night to cough up the contents of their craws. Here and there, specimen cacti rise from the hard landscaping, shadowy shapes like malformed dwarves out of some Tolkien dream. Following Dubose along a walkway of concrete stepping squares, listening to overhead bats using their sharp little teeth to crunch the crisp bodies of flying beetle entrees that are being served after the moth appetizers, Jurgen feels ever more acutely that he is a stranger in a strange land. One of the three agents assigned to the conversion of the people in this residence opens the door. Ahmed al-Adel, he says, for he doesn't expect them to remember his name from the orientation meeting 15 hours earlier. He is a tall, handsome, 30-something son of Iraqi immigrants. Like the others who have invaded this street with MedExpress containers filled with control mechanisms, Ahmed is clean-shaven, neatly barbered, dressed in a black suit and a white shirt and a black tie. He and the other agents came here a little more than 4 hours previously, at 9 o'clock in the evening, but regardless of the hour, it is always easier to elicit quick, complete cooperation from people when FBI agents are dressed and carry themselves as the movies have long portrayed them. Operating to a degree incognito, Jurgen and Dubose avoid the men-in-black cliché. Jurgen favors a desert spa look, a sport coat by Ring Jacket, gray with a white micro-dot pattern, slim-cut white slacks by the same designer, gray suede, seven-eye lace-up ankle-fit trainers by Axel Arigato. In a spirit of fun, he wears a Graph Star Eclipse ultra-slim lightweight titanium watch with an entirely black face, black hands, and black check marks instead of numbers. Dubose, reliably a sartorial embarrassment, looks as though he just came in from plowing a cornfield and didn't completely change clothes, but threw on a couple glitzy items to add some flash for a quick trip to Vegas. "They're in the kitchen," says Ahmed. In these houses reside 11 people who have received nanoweb control mechanisms. They will soon be enlisted in the valley-wide search for the boy and his mother. The residents of these four homes were selected for injection because none is a child below the age of 16. Others have been injected before these people, and still others will be injected in the remaining hours of the night. Their controls are the latest generation and include a feature known as the Whispering Room. While activating the Whispering Room feature, they can communicate via microwave transmission, brain to brain, as the celebrated Elon Musk, founder of Tesla Automobiles, has predicted will one day be possible and desirable. This makes them highly effective searchers. 50 or more individuals, sharing a hive mind, quickly communicating their positions, situations, and discoveries to one another. This residence is supposed to house two people, Robert and Minette Butterworth, both in their mid-30s, he a history teacher, she an English teacher. They are seated at the kitchen table, zip-tied to their chairs, mouths covered with duct tape, though not because there is anyone to be alerted by their cries. Prior to the injections and during the 4 hours after, while the nanoconstructs foil the blood-brain barrier and assemble within their skulls, those who have been chosen to become adjusted people tend to be tedious. They demand their constitutional rights, ask insistent questions, and in general make an annoyance of themselves. Duct tape is the best cure for their tiresome prattle. Robert and Minette are pale, wide-eyed with sustained fright, soon to be under the control of their nanowebs, but they are not the only residents of the house. A younger woman resembling Minette is also duct-taped and sits at the table in a wheelchair. The two agents working with Ahmed al-Adel are here as well. Malcolm Kingman is an imposing African-American with the face and demeanor of a caring man of the cloth, but the direct and filleting stare of a judge at the Nuremberg trials. Zita Hernandez, a pretty woman of perhaps 30, rounds out an admirably diverse crew. Hernandez is of the most interest to Jurgen, not just because of her beauty. She wears exquisitely tailored black slacks, a white button-to-the-throat shirt by Michael Kors, A black blazer from Ralph Lauren. The only thing she needs help with is her shoes. Jurgen would like to dress her, after undressing her. Lovely Zita indicates the pajama-clad woman in the wheelchair. This is Glynis Galworth, Minette's sister. She's visiting from Alexandria, Virginia for a week. She was sleeping in a back bedroom. We didn't know she was there till things were well along here in the kitchen. Jurgen finds this bit of information perplexing. Alexandria is an upscale, sophisticated town. He is not able to imagine willingly leaving Alexandria to spend a week in a small house with unfortunate decor on a dead-end dirt street in this desert wasteland. Zita says, Glynis is paraplegic ever since a spinal injury when she was a teenager. She works in the State Department in D.C. She's too clueless about this situation to be in the know, by which she means to say, she's not one of us. Glynis appears to be as terrified as her sister and the sister's husband.
We injected them, says Michael Kingman, but we're not sure if we should inject her. This is Arcadian 101, DuBose says.
Kingman and Ahmed Al-Adel exchange a look, and then both look at Zita. DuBose smiles at Glynis.
Ma'am, I'm sure you don't know what your sister and brother-in-law got tangled in. This is an urgent matter of national security involving a pending act of nuclear terrorism.
The astonished Minette and Robert shake their heads and protest these outrageous charges through the duct tape. Glynis appears both dubious and frightened, but also confused. DuBose says,
We have an emergency FISA court order allowing a deposition to be performed with a truth serum.
As if even a FISA court could order such a thing.
Your name is not in that court order. My associates should have known you couldn't be included in this procedure. But because the nation's survival is at stake, and this involves top-secret information, we can't allow you to witness the questioning of your sister and her husband.
With that, the big man steps behind the wheelchair and rolls Glynis out of the kitchen, into the living room, and back to the bedroom where she had been sleeping. Carter Jurgen smiles at Zita Hernandez, and she holds his gaze in what seems like an expression of erotic interest. Both Ahmed Al-Adel and Malcolm Kingman flinch and grimace when the gunshot echoes from the back of the house, which does not speak well of them. Zita, however, remains impassive even through the second and third shots. Jurgen likes her a lot. Chapter 7. Deep in the heart of Texas and high in the windowed firewatch, Lori Longren was up far past her usual bedtime, but she wasn't in the least sleepy. Fear affected her like a kind of caffeine, fear for herself and her sisters and her parents. But there was something else besides fear. She stood in the grip of an exciting expectation, waiting for the fireman to roar into sight, not in a red pumper truck with its deluge gun, but in their many pickups and SUVs, the equivalent of an old-fashioned posse, come in high Lone Star style to chase out the evildoers and save the innocent. What she felt was, in fact, more than expectation, something like exhilaration. Her fear was all mixed up with this crazy wild thrill, a reckless confidence that butt was going to be kicked, the bad cast down, the good lifted up, the world made right again. She wasn't a Pollyanna. She knew good didn't always triumph, not at first try anyway. There were a mega million ways things could go wrong. Bad people were often more clever than good people because they spent their entire